You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 18th of January 2018 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show, the youth vote. Matteo Renzi doesn't appear to have it, Jeremy Corbyn clearly does, and US Democrats hope they do. But is it as important as they all think it is? My guests Somnath Battabile and Oscar Guardiola-Rivera will be discussing this and the day's other top stories, including India's helpfully timed test launch of a ballistic missile, how foreign funding is helping a Colombian newspaper report Colombia's peace process, and Trump's White House, the TV series, already. That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. So, welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Somnath Battabile, lecturer in media and development and international journalism at SOAS, and Oscar Guardiola-Rivera, reader in international law and international affairs at Birkbeck College. Welcome both. Now, 6 weeks from now, give or take, Italian voters will go to the polls in an election widely predicted to go badly for Prime Minister Matteo Renzi. Renzi is being especially criticised for his failure to corral the affections of Italy's youth, a cohort which, as a stripling of 39, himself, he was supposed to have a lock on. The youth vote in Italy and elsewhere is clearly important. It is the bedrock of unlikely UK opposition leader Jeremy Corbyn and the focus of the dreams of US Democrats. But the youth vote also tends towards the tempestuous. Somnath, first of all, is it a mistake, do we think, to think of the youth vote as a separate entity? Because attempts by politicians to engage with it almost always go incredibly badly, don't they?
Yes, it does. And because you try to kind of box the youth in a particular segment, either they are disenfranchised or they feel politically lack of motivation. But one the reason we think it's transformative is because 1/5 of the world's population is between that age of 15 to 25. But they have less than 1%, about 1.5% representation in parliament, that age group. Between the 30s and 40s, you have about 11% across the world. And very few of the global South countries have that, you know, most of their parliamentarians are above the age of 25. That's the minimum age bar they put. Mm-hmm. So it's quite logical that the youth might feel disenfranchised. Obama showed, you know, how to bring together social media and the youth and how to get them politically motivated. Therefore, the Democrats feel that in the next elections that, yes, things might turn around. The other thing about youth is if they're not politically engaged, if you look at several of the movements from the last century till now, most of the violent uprisings have been youth movements. I mean, starting with the 1960s Bengal and the Naxal movement to the Arab uprisings. When youth are disenfranchised, political uprisings do follow.
Well, indeed. And you can also make the point that if you sort of engage with or report on or even observe extremist organizations or extremist parties, they are disproportionately youthful enterprises, usually. Oscar, is there, I mean, do we still subscribe to the idea, which I think the Democrats are placing a lot of hope in, especially ahead of this year's midterms, that young folk tend to be towards the left of centre and then perhaps, you know, get old, the traditional trajectory, that you start out idealistic and left of centre and develop into a walking stick, waving crank as the decades elapse?
I know my uncle used to tell me that by the time I was 40, I should be right of center. I'm afraid I've disappointed him. It is to a certain extent a myth, particularly nowadays. What we are witnessing is not simply a sort of rising up of the youth, which, as my colleague just said correctly, is varied. You cannot box it. What we are witnessing is a peculiar conversation between, an older generation and a newer generation. The conversation between Bernie Sanders and a certain generation of young Americans proves that as much as Corbyn's here.
Which, when those are, of course, two instances of youthful voters being quite enraptured by conspicuously older gentlemen.
Or the opposite. I might say that actually, you know, my take on the Corbyn phenomenon is that it is rather the opposite. He is the result of a grassroots movement. Not the same in America. And to answer your question, I think the Democrats should not overstate the importance of the youth both in America for two reasons. The first one is the institutional makeup, electoral makeup of America, which makes it much more difficult for a single sector of the population to change the wider results. But also because what we're witnessing in America also has to do with youth organizations taking various forms. Actually, most of the white American youth voted for Trump. But it is also the case that we see Antifa and other organizations. We might see a radicalization of the youth in America because of Trump.
I mean, can you, Somnath, can you generalize about whether younger voters are likelier to respond not to specific issues but to specific personalities? And I'm thinking here of the weird contradiction of Jeremy Corbyn in particular, whose fans and supporters are disproportionately young, but like young people in the UK did, they were overwhelmingly pro-EU. They were pro-Remain, whereas Corbyn has been a lifelong leaver. He did campaign officially for Remain, but in an extremely half-hearted manner. How do you explain that contradiction? It is quite odd.
Yes, but one of the things about being in opposition is that you do not have to lay down much policy. And so Corbyn is, at the moment, being able to please everyone and saying... And he has been able to be very shifty about where he stands on Brexit, whether he wants to be in the single market. One day he is, one day he is not. So this is a very shifty policy. But because he can promise, much more than he would be if he ever comes to power, he has managed to garner a lot of support among the youth. Also, this time, during the elections, the Labour Party actually managed, through its social media campaign, through grassroots campaign, to mobilize the youth, which the Tories didn't. And the Tories, obviously, traditionally, it's looked as a party which caters to a much older population. And that's one of the biggest fears of right-wing parties across. As you said, you tend to move from left of center to the other side as age gets on. So most right-wing parties do kind of fear that their the voting population shrinks.
That's often compensated for, though, by the fact that at least in countries where voting isn't compulsory, older people are more likely to vote than younger people. I mean, just on the question of turnout, Oscar, are there hard and fast rules that people have discovered, not for getting necessarily young people to vote in a particular way, but for getting them to vote at all?
There aren't, silver bullets. There's a lot of
Compulsory voting would be.
No, certainly not. It wouldn't work. I mean, it hasn't worked. It didn't work in Chile.
It does work in Australia.
Yeah, but you don't see the youth really coming in great numbers or supporting a particular candidate because of those impositions. Rather, as it is the case in Britain, I would say that the youth in this country has realized that the way the system is working, the way the economics is working, is foreclosing their future. And that's why they mobilized. I mean, they began to mobilize back in 2009. They were in the streets when tuition fees went up. And then you saw, on the basis of those organizations, you saw the rise of momentum. And then you see Corbyn appearing in the scene. And what I have seen, street by street, during the campaign for the snap general election, I saw a lot of young voters going to the streets, knocking on doors, talking to people. And that experience of talking to people and of realizing that it is their future which is at stake, I think that's what has fired them.
Okay, well, let's move along somewhat now and take a look at India, which has today joined in on the current intercontinental ballistic missile craze, test firing an Agni V. Is Agni V or Agni 5?
Agni 5.
Agni 5. It's the whole Roman numerals thing. Confused me. They fired it from Abdul Kalam Island off the coast of Odisha State. It's not the first test of an Agni 5, though the timing of the launch is arguably somewhat tactless, what with one thing and another. Harumphing is likely to be especially voluble from the directions of Beijing and Islamabad. Somnath, it's not the first test, as I was just saying, of one of these, but is it a, I mean, could they have waited a bit
Well, the timing is suspect. But you know, there are a couple of things I want to kind of lay out. First of all, it's not an intercontinental missile. That's about 12,000 kilometers. It should be the range. This is a medium range ballistic missile. It's, I mean, India wants
to... There's continents closer together than 5,000 kilometers.
what the 12,000 miles does is it can globally... It threatens you globally. While this medium range has their, you know, Shanghai is supposedly the longest reach. But it's an important point. The reason I say this is because India does have an intercontinental missile under development. It's kept under wraps. It's called the Shakti. And it should have a range of about 12,000 kilometers.
That's something to look forward to.
Well, so it had several misfires. So, and as you correctly said, this is a kind of a developmental process. But it's important because the earlier test was about 3,000, and we keep on saying this miles, 3,500 miles to 5,000 miles. It means a lot when India thinks of China as an adversary. When it was Pakistan, it didn't matter. You know, it was 1,000 miles or 2,000 miles, you had Pakistan within range. I hate using this terminology, mm-hmm. within range, but in the last few years, as India is playing up its global power and global presence, US tacitly supporting India as a force against China, to neutralize China, if that can be the case. So China has become a major adversary. China wasn't spoken of so much through the 90s and the early 2000s. Suddenly, Indian spending, India's the biggest importer of defense anywhere across the world. 1.3 million in armed forces is the third largest. So, you know, it's a major military player. As you say, the timing is suspect. But this was the way Indian military strategy would have moved, and wanting to have all strategic Chinese cities under possible threat.
So just to follow that up, Somnath, the Agni 5 is specifically manufactured, tested and deployed with China in mind?
Because whatever earlier capabilities India had, Pakistan, the possibility of attacking Pakistan was always there. Mm. This one brings in furthest Chinese targets into range. Yes, it does. And if you take what has been happening between India and China in the Western Himalayas in the last year, the Doklam standoff, this is a way of saying, perhaps, you know, deterring China from further military adventures. But also it's a statement which the army and the government, I think, wants to make now to China, that the 1960s war is over and we are not completely... But China... The other problem, though, when I say this, is China is a far superior military power to India, you know. So, but with a bit of US and Israeli help, India is building up its arsenal.
Well, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu presently is visiting India. He's also claiming that the deal for India to buy Spike anti-tank missiles from Israel is back on track. Oscar, do you detect a subtext here beyond any need for technical development?
You don't have to be a lecturer in international relations to detect the subtext. This is not a subtle...
However, you're here, so go ahead.
It's not a subtle message. It's a very clear message. As we heard before, you have the US and Israel tacitly, inverted commas, supporting India as a part of an attempt to deter China. It is also the case that India is ruffling its feathers as a superpower, or at least a regional power, and defense, and particularly, you know, belonging to that most exclusive club, the nuclear club, does that very well. I do not think this will deter China as much. It's one of those messages that seems to be, you know, purely symbolic, yet it says what needs to be said.
Somnath, do these things play well in, you know, as a political stunt? Is there still a great sense of, or was there ever a great sense of patriotic pride among India's people invested in these missiles?
Hugely, hugely. The nuclear test was basically just that, to kind of say we, the nation, kind of a statement. And especially with the right of center government, which is kind of with a Hindutva ideology at its core, mobilizing the youth, especially in religion and national identity. So this kind of military power and its show, parading itself, plays very much into the exact hands of what Modi wants to do and how Modi is establishing himself as kind of almost, you know, what should I say? I don't want to use the word fascist because it goes too far. But as a leader who's powerful, who is single-minded in his determination to kind of take India onto the next level, as you were saying, superpower. So, that kind of imagery plays very well. And the immediate tweets from the president, from the prime minister, from the defense minister, kind of keeps re-emphasizing Indians should be proud, India should be proud. I mean, I don't know what India should be proud about. 450 million people below poverty line. India shouldn't be proud.
But I remember being struck by this, and it's a long time ago, but I happened to be in Pakistan either, it was when or just after they tested a nuclear weapon for the first time. So this is 98, I guess.
Yes.
And I was really struck by just talking to people in Rawalpindi and Peshawar, which is where I was, how people were genuinely excited. It
absolutely.
Was like a World Cup win.
Yes, it's a dancing on the street, dancing on the streets kind of scenario. Yes, absolutely.
Okay, we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Muller, along with Somnath Batabile and Oscar Guardiola Rivera. Coming up next, news, both fake and real.
Monocle has bureau around the world, in Tokyo, Hong Kong, Singapore, London, Toronto, and New York City. In New York City, our bureau chief is Ed Stocker.
You really can be anyone you want to be in New York. You can dress exactly how you like. You can act exactly how you like. There's that tolerance and acceptance that I think perhaps doesn't exist quite like it does in New York in any other city in the world. There's an energy and excitement to living here, and that's what makes it a great place to work in and to also live.
Hear from Monocle's editors and correspondents on the stories that matter and the places that matter every day on Monocle 24.
You are back with Midori House with me, Andrew Muller. Still with me are Somnath Batabile and Oscar Guardiola Rivera. Now, this week saw the announcement of US President Donald Trump's inaugural fake news awards, or as the Republican Party's actual website described them, the highly anticipated 2017 fake news awards. Highly anticipated now being an entertaining euphemism for repeatedly delayed. I'm going to start talking to my publisher about my next book. I just try and think of it as highly anticipated next time they ask me where it is. These awards were, as might have been anticipated, indeed highly anticipated, essentially yet another self-pitying tantrum by Trump, and as such need not concern us beyond their utility, queuing up discussion of a report in the Columbia Journalism Review about how good journalism can encourage civil society. Oscar, this is the Columbia 2020 project of the El Espectador newspaper. How does it work? What is this project they're doing?
First, let me say I'm going to steal that title from this brilliant title.
Highly anticipated.
Yes. Secondly,
it's going to be used by journalists all
over
the world.
Sure.
Where's this copy? It's not late. It is merely highly anticipated.
I'm going to run and trademark it. I must say I write a column, weekly column for El Espectador, so I'm not going to be partial here. I think that this particular project is a wonderful example of what can happen when money, and it's not an incredibly huge amount, is directed to fund investigative journalism.
Because the key part of this, of course, is that funding is coming from overseas, from the EU, the UN, among others.
Correct, and the German embassy in particular. But here, that money was went to a project that existed before. I must give credit where it belongs. Gloria Castrillon, a wonderful young female journalist who, as many women in Latin America, are at the helm of interesting projects concerning news and politics and so on, precisely because the violence has been directed against them. So voices like hers or Holman Morris and other journalists were, kept alive a sense of truth during the darkest years of Colombia's civil war, which, not long ago, during the Uribe administration, when he did what Trump is doing now in the U.S., tried to silence everyone who was trying to speak the truth. That's what Colombia 2020 is all about. This is a project that funds journalists from El Espectador to go to mainly rural areas of Colombia and to seek the voices of those who have never had a platform. peasants, indigenous peoples, racially discriminated populations in Colombia. And all of a sudden, if you click in the webpage of Colombia 2020 in El Espectador, you see how different it is from even the rest of the newspaper. Is the other voices, is real stories, is not just your usual diet of us, the boring experts, talking to a fine broadcaster, but rather, you know, the protagonist of the war telling the story. And this is very important because the peace process is not just about the end of violence. It is about the beginning of truth.
But does the fact that it has to be funded from outside sources, philanthropically funded as it were, suggest that there actually isn't a market for reading these stories? That if the newspaper tried to do it itself, it wouldn't be able to justify it because there isn't the interest there?
You're absolutely right, but you must add to that an important element in the particular Latin American context. Journalism in Latin America is very complicated, among other things, because it's mostly, almost totally privately owned. So to speak of freedom of the press in Latin America is complicated because usually you have big economic groups owning all the newspapers, which is why it isn't a surprise that O Globo in Brazil falls in line behind the coup against Dilma and the current political persecution of Lula da Silva. The same goes for Venezuela, the other end of the political spectrum. So you have that problem. We never had anything even remotely close to the BBC. No public funding for and hence no neutrality, which is why these monies coming from outside are so important for these projects and allow these projects to happen.
Somnath, there is a balance to be struck here, though, isn't there? Or maybe that's not the right phrase. There needs to be a transparent process, because obviously there is a long history of foreign funding running local media in various parts around the world, not all of it terribly noble. How can this be done in a way that nobody at the receiving end suspects the motives of the donors?
Well, the funding model of media all across the world has to be rethought, because today's youth, and I mean by everybody today reading the newspapers, think newspapers, news comes for free. You know, we pick up news either at tube stations or we read them in news. No one wants to pay for news. If you don't pay for news, someone is paying. Either you have really, non-investigative journalists, if that can be a phrase, or you have journalism which is subsidized by advertisement. So in that scenario, you do not, it's almost becomes very difficult, as you were saying, by privately owned television or newspapers to have news which helps in rebuilding places which have been in conflict. Just to give a quick sense of history, I mean, the post-colonial nations since post-1950s, the initial influx, most of the West tried to invest money in media. I mean, if you see the quick example I can give of is India, where Ford Foundation started the television program with $500,000. And then, because India already had a thriving newspaper industry, the nation is imagined through the press, the Times of India or the BBC. So a Greek media, every nation has been imagined or is understood through mediation. So unless and until we find ways, and I'm not saying that Western nations or rich nations funding poor nations, there's a huge problem. But we have to find ways of funding media which can work towards rebuilding conflict areas. In South Africa, it was very important. Yeah. With Truth and Reconciliation. Bangladesh, it was very important. In Pakistan, where there is a very difficult army presence, media plays a huge role, especially the English language media, which is doing fantastic work. So I can't say that this model works, or the BBC model will work, or the private channels, news channels will work. But at the present scenario in the last 15, 20 years, because of the huge privatization of media, we find increasingly that free and impartial news is getting more and more difficult to put out.
Okay, well, finally tonight, and largely thanks to a previous self-pitying presidential tantrum, Michael Wolff's expose of the Trump White House, Fire and Fury, has become an instant bestseller. It is now inevitably to be made into a television series, having been purchased by Endeavour Content, though no network is as yet attached. But how possible is it to make a TV series about an administration while it is still in office, especially this one, which has a remarkable knack for consistently making what may have seemed a seismic sex scandal this time last week. Look, a mere cheese sandwich measured against whatever fresh hell it has served up this week. Oscar, first of all, is this, I mean, how doable even is this?
I'm really looking forward to question number one. Which genre? Is it going to be comedy or tragedy or farce? Question number two.
Possibly all three.
Question number two. Who's going to be cast in the role of the porn star who's making Trump's life difficult
that's
now?
That's tomorrow's Fresh Hell, I believe. that's penciled in for. But I'm more interested in who's going to play Donald Trump. My suggestion...
That was question number three.
My suggestion is Donald Trump.
I think that would
He's
be...
He's a television star.
Exactly.
I'm pretty certain he would love to do so. But actually, on the serious side of this is that this can work. I mean, it has worked in the past. I remember when I was living in the United States, there was a comedy. This is the pre-9/11 Bush Jr. years, and the comedy was called That's My Bush. And then after at some point, he gets fired, and Dick Cheney takes charge. The comedy is now titled What a Dick. So question number four, what is going to be the title of this one? Because Fire and Fury is brilliant, but is it going to be to get the numbers, the viewers in? Can television change the way we think about politics? I think it can. And it would be very interesting to see how they adapt
usually it changes the way we think about it in retrospect. I mean, I think it's clear enough that The West Wing, for example, was sort of a reimagining of the Clinton years. Yeah. It was, you know, Jed Bartlett was the president people kind of wished Bill Clinton had been, instead of the Bill Clinton we actually got. But, I mean, Somnath, if you have the Fire and the Fury, if they get it on screen to run concurrently with Trump actually being president, is there a worry that it kind of encourages people to forget that the actual administration is really happening, and just, you know, encourages people to think this is all just a television spectacle?
Question number six.
I have led us through several rabbit holes.
Administration right actually there. Real?
I know. I feel like we should now be having this discussion in a French accent.
You have asked a causal question, which I have no answer to. Will this lead to that? I don't know. But there'll be huge legal quagmires the production company will be put in by the White House. That's for sure. This book was almost ready and they rolled it out. So whatever television they will attempt, Trump and his lawyers will try and put as many obstacles as possible to it. A television series takes time to produce. So we're not expecting it next month. So, you know, these are two reality checks we have to keep in mind, that it's not going to come out ASAP. It'll take at least 6 to 8 months to a year to roll out, and then we'll see what happens. But I haven't read the book as yet, and so I don't want to comment on the book. But reading the reviews, and listening to one of the late night interviews of the author, it's very clear that he has also imagined himself in situations where he was not. So, after writing a fluff piece for the president and warming his way into the White House, he has kind of burned all his sources. So. But I don't want to comment on the book itself till one reads it. But to come back to your question, what will happen? I don't know.
But we can we not, Oscar, or whoever commissions this, can absolutely rely on Trump himself turning it into a massive hit.
Absolutely.
By complaining about it while
the ratings
happening.
Will go. Absolutely. Shooting through the roof.
I mean, he's going to put his lawyers to ban it or something like that, and which will just invite more and more curiosity. I mean, it's a brilliant, it's made for television precisely because of the actual situation in the White House, where, as you suggested, we don't know which one is the real thing and which one is the comedy.
Well, on that philosophical quandary, that does bring us to the end of today's show. Somnath Battabile, Oscar Guardiola Rivera, thank you both very much for joining us at Midori House. Today's show was produced by Ben Ryland, researched by Gaia Lutz and James Kitchen. Our studio manager was David Stevens. There's more music next at 1900. It's The Urbanist. I'm back with more on the day's main stories on the daily at 2200. Midori House returns at the same time tomorrow, 1800 London. I'm Andrew Muller. Thanks for listening.